Thank you, Laura, and good afternoon, everyone. How good is it to be able to be finally back together again? Let's hope it's a harbinger of things to come. This is the fourth time that I've had the privilege of addressing the National Press Club, so thank you for having me back. I know it's been a very big week for the Press Club, so thank you for having me back. As I've done on the previous three occasions, I've entitled my remarks today, The Year Ahead. What I would like to do is to talk about our latest economic forecasts, including for inflation. I'd like to talk about the outlook for monetary policy and yesterday's decision by the Reserve Bank Board to end the bond purchase program. In summary, I remain optimistic about Australia's prospects. Our economy has weathered the pandemic better than was expected. Jobs growth is strong and the unemployment rate is low. Household and business balance sheets are in good shape. Wages growth is picking up and inflation is closer to target. These are all positive developments. At the same time though, the country does face some challenges. The pandemic is not yet behind us and a sharp pickup in inflation, particularly in the United States, has added a new source of uncertainty to the outlook. We also face the challenge of lifting productivity growth, including through investing in the workforce skills and technologies that are really important to generating increases in real wages over time. And over time, and as conditions allow, we'll face the challenge of navigating a return to more normal settings of monetary policy. So while I'm optimistic about the country's prospects, we do face some challenges that we need to give attention to. In looking to the year ahead, though, a useful place to start is to look back at the year just past and see what lessons we can draw. I think the table in my first chart here helps do that. It shows the outcomes for the key economic variables last year and the forecast that I talked about this time last year when I was last at the National Press Club. But the final column of this table tells a pretty clear story. The economy performed significantly better than we expected last year. GDP growth is likely to have been around 5% in 2021. That compares with our forecast a year ago of 3.5%. This outperformance is despite the serious setback caused by Delta in the third quarter. As you can see, the unemployment rate has also declined by much more than we had expected and now stands at just 4.2%, the lowest rate since the peak of the resources boom. These stronger GDP and labour market outcomes have translated into higher inflation, significantly higher than we're expecting. We had expected underlying inflation to be 1.5% last year, yet the actual outcome was 2.6%. Headline inflation was higher still at 3.5%, boosted by a large increase in petrol prices and the cost of constructing a new home. As you can see, wages growth was also higher than we were expecting, although the difference here is smaller than for the other variables, and overall wages growth remains low. I think this experience reminds us of the difficulty of economic forecasting in a pandemic. I think we all know that, and I'm very conscious of that difficulty. But it also points to three broader observations. The first is the economy has been remarkably resilient. That's good news. The second is that the link between the strength of the real economy and prices and wages still exists, remains alive, that link. And the third lesson is that the supply side really matters, not just for the economic activity, but for prices as well. I think each of those three observations are also going to be relevant for the year ahead. The Reserve Bank will be releasing its latest economic forecasts on Friday and the quarterly statement on monetary policy. Ahead of that, I can summarise the key economic variables for you. And I'm going to start with GDP. As you can see here, our central forecast is that the Australian economy will grow by 4.25% this year and then around 2% next year. This is a stronger outlook than we had 3 months ago, especially given the higher than expected starting point. One source of ongoing certainty is the possibility of further virus outbreaks, and the past month or so have reminded us of the risks here. Prior to Omicron, the economy had established strong positive momentum. It had bounced back quickly following the Delta-related lockdowns. This momentum, though, wasn't sustained into the new year, with Omicron leading to many people having to isolate at home. It interrupted supply chains and it affected spending as people limited their activities. Yet, once again, the economy has shown remarkable resilience. Australians have adjusted and they've adapted, and we still expect GDP growth to be positive in the March quarter, although only modestly so. The worst of the disruptive effects from Omicron now appear to be behind us. Supply chains and workforce management issues, which have been significant, are gradually being addressed. And I think as case numbers trend lower over the weeks ahead, the economy will bounce back strongly and we'll see a sharp pickup in spending. While Omicron has delayed the recovery of the Australian economy, it's not derailed it. That recovery is being underpinned by a number of factors. These include household balance sheets, which are generally in good shape. Over the past couple of years, the household sector has accumulated more than $200 billion in additional savings over and above what it would normally have accumulated. $200 billion, that's a lot of money, and it's there to support spending over the period ahead. There's also an upswing in business investment underway, and there's a very large pipeline of residential building to be completed over the next year or so. The macroeconomic policy settings also remain supportive of growth. Governments are still planning significant infrastructure spending, which is good, and monetary policy remains accommodative. So there are a number of factors that are combining together to give us optimism about the Australian economy over the next year or so. Turning now to the labour market, the outlook has also continued to improve. The unemployment rate has now declined to the low fours. It's declined to that mark earlier than we had expected, and we're expecting it to go lower. Again, good news. Our central forecast is for the unemployment rate to decline to around 3.75% by the end of this year, and then to be sustained around that level next year. If this comes to pass, it would be a significant achievement, and it's one that we shouldn't underestimate. Australia has not experienced unemployment rates this low for half a century. The last time we had an unemployment rate below 4% for any period of time was in the early 1970s, half a century ago. The decline in the unemployment rate has been accompanied by a welcome decline in underemployment. I hope you can see here. Underemployment is the lowest that it's been in 13 years. There's also been a sharp rise in labour force participation in Australia. This stands in stark contrast to what's happened in the United States and the United Kingdom, where labour force participation has declined quite significantly. In Australia today, the share of the working age population with a job is as high as it's ever been. Again, a significant achievement which we shouldn't underestimate. The forward-looking indicators suggest that the demand for workers remains strong, and is evident here. I'm having trouble seeing where I'm up to on the graphs, but I hope this is the graph that shows job vacancies reached a record high in November, and job advertisements are also at a very high level. And the information from our business liaison programs is that Omicron has not changed this positive story. More than half the businesses that we're talking to on a regular basis say they intend to increase their workforce over the coming months. And very few businesses that we talk to say they're going to cut their workforces. As you would all know, there's been an increase in staff turnover, and many firms are reporting to us that it's quite difficult to find workers with the right skills at the moment. Once the labour market disruptions from Omicron have dissipated, we expect some of the additional demand for labour to be met with a further rise in labour force participation, again to reach new highs. We also expect an increase in average hours worked, as part-time workers have more success in finding the additional hours that they want to work than they've had in over recent years. So expecting both unemployment and underemployment to decline further. Turning now to inflation, there's also been an upside surprise. The pickup in inflation reflects both the strength of our economy and the significant disruptions on the supply side.
headline inflation in particular has been boosted by a 32% increase in petrol prices over the past year. 32%, it's large. And there's also been a nearly 8% increase in the cost of constructing a new home. There have also been larger than usual increases in the prices of a wide range of consumer durables. It would appear there was very little discounting in the December quarter. It's hardly surprising. There was very strong demand as we came out of lockdowns, and many firms were having trouble staffing and filling their shelves. Their inventories were low. So strong demand, low inventories, and problem staffing. It's not surprising that firms didn't discount, and we saw more inflation than normal. Looking ahead, we expect underlying inflation to increase further, largely reflecting the ongoing difficulties on the supply side, including from Omicron. But as these difficulties are resolved, and I think they will be resolved, some moderation in inflation is expected. Then, over time, stronger growth in labour costs is expected to become the more dominant factor driving inflation. So our central forecast is that underlying inflation will be around 2.75% this year and next, although I think we'll have a period where it's higher than that over the next couple of quarters as the effects of these supply side problems wash through the numbers. Wage growth has also picked up, but as I hope you can see here, it's just returned to the rates prevailing before the pandemic. A further pickup in wages is expected, although there is substantial inertia in aggregate wage outcomes in Australia. This inertia comes from the fact we've got multi-year enterprise agreements, a review of the awards which takes place just once a year, and public sector wages policies which tend to move slowly over time. So there's quite a lot of inertia coming from our institutional arrangements. So our central forecast is that the wage price index will increase by 2.75% this year, and 3% next year. The broader measures of labour costs that we track, which are also important for inflation, are expected to be growing at faster rates than this. This reflects the increase in the superannuation contributions and the pay increases that arise when people switch jobs and their jobs are reclassified in a tight labour market. So we will be keeping a very close eye on these broader measures of labour costs, not just the wage price index. So that's a summary of our forecasts. I would, though, like to return to the point I made at the outset, that is, the actual outcomes can be quite different from the central forecast, something that I'm very conscious of, especially during a global pandemic with all its uncertainties. We still can't be sure how the pandemic will evolve, and we can't be sure how people will respond to further outbreaks. We can't be sure how they'll spend that more than $200 billion they've accumulated. There are also major geopolitical uncertainties at the moment, and our largest trading partner, China, is going through quite a difficult adjustment in its property market. On the inflation and wages fronts, there are also significant uncertainties, and these partly stem from the uniqueness of the period that we've been living through. Over the past 2 years, there's been very, very strong demand for goods globally. We couldn't buy services, we couldn't travel, we couldn't go to restaurants, so right around the world, people bought lots of goods. And this happened at exactly the same time that the ability of the global production system to supply those goods was impaired. People had trouble working factories and the distribution system got clogged up at various points. So we had very strong demand for goods colliding with an impaired supply capacity. What happened to prices? They went up. And they went up quite strongly. It's unclear what the timing and what the pace will be of the normalization of consumption patterns. It's unclear whether, having bought all these goods, whether goods demand will slow and will go back to services. I think we will, but the pace and timing of that's unclear. I think there's also uncertainty about how quickly the supply and distribution problems are resolved. I think they will be resolved. The market's a wonderful thing. The prices go up, firms respond, they find solutions, and businesses find solutions to the staffing problem. So the system can self-correct, but it takes time. We're unsure how much time and over what period it will be, but I'm confident the system will self-correct. We're just not sure of the timing of that. we can't rule out the possibility that some of the recent price increases are reversed as more normal balance between supply and demand is established. And in any case, for inflation to be sustained at current rates, the prices of many goods would have to increase at the same rate that they've been increasing recently. They've stepped up a lot, and for inflation to be sustained at the current rate, we'd have to see that ongoing. It's more likely that we'll see some moderation in the price increases, particularly for goods. All this means there are significant uncertainties about the persistence of the recent price increases. It's possible that they're the start of a period of persistently higher inflation, but they could also simply be a shift in the level of prices as a result of this unique period we've been living through, with very strong demand and impaired supply. There are also some significant uncertainties about the supply side of the labour market and how wages are going to respond. Right at the moment, we're experiencing, again, a unique combination. Record labour force participation, a pandemic that's affecting whether people can go to work, and we're experiencing a gradual reopening of our international borders after they've been closed for 2 years. More powerful forces. In addition, we have no contemporary evidence about how the labour market and how wages are going to respond to an unemployment rate below 4%. So the last time we were there was more than 50 years ago, so we have no contemporary evidence. We do know, though, that when the unemployment rate in New South Wales and Victoria got close to 4% a couple of years ago, wages growth was 2 and a bit. So that's the only evidence we have. No doubt we'll get more evidence over the next couple of years, but at the moment that's the only evidence we have. But the point I want to emphasise is there are a lot of unanswered questions. We're unlikely to know the answers to these questions quickly. There are many moving parts at the moment on both the demand side and the supply side of the economy, and it will take time for those issues to be resolved. And that's very relevant to the board's deliberations about monetary policy, which I'd now like to turn. I want to start with the board's decision yesterday to end the bond purchase program, and the final purchases under this program will take place on Thursday next week, the 10th of February. In taking this decision, the board considered the three criteria that have guided it right through the pandemic. Those criteria are the actions of other central banks, the functioning of our own bond market, and most importantly, the actual and expected progress towards our goals of full employment and inflation consistent with the target. All three criteria pointed to the same conclusion, and that's to bring the bond purchase program to an end. Most other central banks have completed their programs or will shortly do so. That's relevant to us because one of the reasons we introduced our own program was that other central banks were doing this. If we hadn't also purchased bonds, our bond yields would have been higher and our exchange rate would have been higher, and this would have impeded the economic recovery from the pandemic. So because others were doing this, we need to do it. Once they stop, there's a case for us to stop as well. In terms of the second criteria, our bond market is continuing to function reasonably well, and the RBA's stock lending activities are helping with that. But there have been some pressure points recently. This is evident around the three-year mark, where there has been a gap between the price of the physical bonds and the futures contracts. I think, as you can see in this next chart, amongst the range of bonds the Reserve Bank has been buying, we own 42% of the outstanding stock, and there are some bond lines where we own 60% of the stock of the Australian government securities on issue. Our assessment is that the market could accommodate further purchases by the RBA, but that there would be a rising probability of further strains emerging. So that also pointed to in the direction of drawing the program to a close. But the most important criteria was the third one, and that's the actual and expected progress towards our goals. Since November, we've made significantly faster progress than we're expecting. Again, that's good news. The unemployment rate is now at 4.2%, as I've said, and underlying inflation is at 2.6%. For the first time in some years, the achievement of our goals is now within sight. In these circumstances, the board judged that now was the right time to draw the bond purchase program to a close. There are four additional points that I would like to make in this context. The first is that our bond purchase program has played an important role in achieving this progress that I've just talked about towards our goals. It's been important in complementing our other monetary policy measures. The purchases have lowered funding costs, they've supported asset values, and they've led to a lower exchange rate than otherwise. As a result, more people have jobs and inflation is closer to target. The second point is that the cessation of our bond purchase program does not represent a tightening of monetary policy. The accumulated international evidence is that it is the stock of bonds purchased rather than the weekly or monthly flow of purchases that matters. By mid-February, the RBA will have purchased over $350 billion of government bonds under our various programs. As you can see in this chart, our balance sheet will have more than tripled over the pandemic to around $650 billion. These purchases and the associated expansion of our balance sheet are providing ongoing support to the Australian economy. So the cessation of the bond purchase program does not represent a tightening of monetary policy. The third point is that we have not yet made a decision about reinvesting the proceeds of maturing bonds. Unlike many other countries, there are not maturities of government bonds in Australia every week or every month. As you can see in this chart, there are gaps, large gaps in the maturity profile, and these gaps mean that the Reserve Bank Board has time to make a decision. The next maturity in an Australian government bond is in July. Ahead of that, the board will consider the issue of reinvestment at its meeting in May, and the key considerations will be the state of the economy and the outlook for inflation and unemployment. The fourth and the final point is that the decision to end the bond purchase program does not mean that an increase in the cash rate is imminent. I recognise that in a number of other countries, the ending of the bond purchase program has been followed closely, or is expected to be followed closely, by an increase in the policy rate. This is in contrast to earlier episodes of quantitative easing, and it reflects the current circumstances of these countries, which are quite different to our own. As you can see here, while inflation in Australia has picked up, it remains substantially lower than the 7% rate in the United States, the 5.5% rate in the United Kingdom, nearly 6% rate in New Zealand, 5% in Germany. So our situation is quite different. The pickup in inflation in Australia has also not been accompanied by strong wages growth as it has been in the United States and the United Kingdom, where labour force participation and labour supply have declined. So the outcomes on inflation so far are quite different in Australia to many other countries, and the labour supply story is quite different as well, and as a result wage growth is quite different. So these are very important differences, and the Reserve Bank Board has discussed them a lot. Our lower rate of inflation and the lower wages growth are key reasons why we don't need to move in lockstep with others. As I've said on previous occasions, the board will not increase the cash rate until inflation is sustainably in the 2-3% range. Given the recent inflation data and the forecast that I talked about before, I'd like to provide some additional detail on our thinking here for you. We do not have a specific definition of what constitutes sustainably in the target range. The actual rate of inflation is relevant, as are the trajectories for inflation and the outlook. So too is the breadth of price pressures in the economy and the factors driving them. Based on the evidence we have so far, it's too early to conclude that inflation is sustainably in the target range. In terms of underlying inflation, we have just reached the midpoint of the target range for the first time in over 7 years. We've reached the midpoint for the first time in 7 years. And doing this comes on the back of very significant disruptions in supply chains and distribution networks, which we expect to be resolved over time. It also comes at a time when aggregate wage growth in Australia remains low, and its rate that's unlikely to be consistent with the inflation target being sustained around the midpoint of the target range unless productivity growth in Australia turns out to be very weak. And as I discussed earlier, there are a range of significant uncertainties, both about the persistence of the price pressures and developments in the labour market. And these uncertainties are going to take time to be resolved. We are in the position where we can take some time to obtain greater clarity on these issues. And countries with higher rates of inflation have less scope here. The board of the Reserve Bank is prepared to be patient as it monitors the evolution of these various factors that are affecting inflation in Australia. It's also relevant that Australia is within sight of a historic milestone. That's having the national unemployment rate below 4%. This is important because low unemployment brings with it very real economic and social benefits for many Australians and for the communities in which we all live. These benefits shouldn't be underestimated. Full employment is one of the RBA's legislated objectives, and the board is committed to playing its role in achieving that objective, consistent with also achieving the inflation target. As we navigate towards full employment, we do have scope to take the time to distill the balance between supply and demand in the economy. Over the course of this year, we'll be watching how the various supply side problems resolve and the effect of this on prices. We'll be watching consumption patterns and whether they normalise and at what speed they normalise. We will also be looking for further evidence that labour costs are growing at a rate consistent with inflation being sustained within the target range. I expect this evidence will emerge over time, but it's unlikely to do so quickly. Finally, I would like to make it clear that the RBA is committed to achieving the inflation target. The inflation target remains at the centre of our monetary policy framework. We don't want to see inflation too low, and we don't want to see inflation too high. We will do what is necessary to maintain low and stable inflation in Australia, which is important not just in its own right, but it's also a precondition for a sustained period of full employment, which we all hope we can achieve. To conclude, the year ahead will no doubt have its challenges, and I'm sure it will have its surprises as well, just like the year just passed has had. But standing here in early February, we are closer to full employment and achieving the inflation target than we had anticipated. It's been a difficult few years for the country, but our economy has proven to be resilient, and Australians are adapting to living with the virus. From my perspective, this augurs well for the future. I wish you all the best for the year ahead. Thank you very much for listening and for coming in person today. And Laura, I look forward to answering your questions.
Thanks so much, Governor. They are indeed challenging times, and the question of policy credibility becomes central in that. So I suppose I'd like to open by asking about a couple of things here. One of them is the Reserve Bank's decision to set the three-year bond rate have it on hold at about 0.1%. Subsequently, when the markets moved against you, the bank was sort of seemed to be very slow to actually back that position. And also, of course, you famously suggested that rates wouldn't move till 2024. Now, you know, one has to be flexible, but obviously you've had to walk away from that. What does the bank do now to sort of set out really clear goals to the markets and really clear signals to the markets about where monetary policy is heading in such uncertain times?
Thank you. I think what we can do is set out our forecasts, as I've done today, so that you can evaluate them. And we can also set out as clearly as we can our reaction function, so how we're going to respond to those forecasts. What we've seen over the past year or so is the economy has done much, much better than we thought. The downturn from the first part of the pandemic wasn't as severe, and the bounce back has been much stronger. That has come as a surprise to us, and we've responded to it. That's a responsible thing to do. And I'll continue to try and set out our forecasts and our reaction function. You can all make your judgment about whether that's reasonable and how we should respond. It's quite significant that we have made faster progress towards full employment and the inflation target than we had expected. And not surprisingly, all else equal, that's going to bring forward the timing of the expected increase in interest rates.
I think
that's pretty clear. Yep.
Yeah, yep. Just have to
start
against the rules.
There we go. I'm the president. I suppose the problem, though, is last year we were talking about forecasts of not moving rates till 2024, and in yesterday's statement of monetary policy, you were basically saying, well, we don't know what's going to happen to wages and prices, so we can't really sort of say where we're going next. Is it just a question that we've got a couple of signals coming up on wages in particular in the next couple of months, that things are just too uncertain, or is this something that also helps you get over the hump of the federal election?
The federal election isn't a relevant consideration in our decision making. What we're driven by is achieving full employment inflation consistent with the target, and there's a lot of discussion of inflation at the moment. Rightly so. We've got to remember that underlying inflation has only just got to the midpoint of the target band for the first time in 7 years. So I don't think that requires an immediate response. We've been below that in previous addresses. The only people criticising us because inflation was too low. And we're also on the cusp of this historic milestone of getting unemployment down. And I think we can test how far we can get the unemployment rate down without having an inflation problem in the country, and that's worth doing. I didn't expect us to be in this situation. We don't have a crystal ball, there's a lot of uncertainty, but what we have done is respond to the changed circumstances we find ourselves, and I understand that in some people's eyes that damages our credibility. We admit we don't have a crystal ball. Things happen that we don't expect, but what I hope you expect of us is that we respond to that and try and explain why. The result of that might be damaged credibility for the central bank, but I hope people can see the fact that the economy evolves in an unexpected way and we respond to it, and actually this is good news. And I'm hoping we get further good news over the course of this year, and as we make further progress towards full employment and we can sustain inflation of roughly 2.5%, we will be able to normalise monetary policy. I hope and expect that to happen, but as we know, unexpected things can happen, and when they do, we'll respond.
Jessica Irvine has a question.
Jessica Irvine, Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. I share your excitement to be here in real life. My question is about wages growth. What is the minimum standard of evidence that you would accept to convince you that wages are growing at a rate that is consistent with keeping inflation sustainably in the midpoint of the band? And I'd refer you to last year you were talking about wages growth needing to be 3 point something to be consistent with that. Do you still want to see a 3 in front? And if so, the graphs you've shown us show we don't get wage price index back to 3% until the end of next year. So do you actually want to eyeball a wage price index report, a quarterly report, with a 3% annual rate? Or would you be able to go off like a quarterly rate of 0.8 and go, well, if it was a 0.8 one quarter, 0.9 the next quarter, annualise that, we're at 3%? What's the standard of evidence that we should wait for before we get excited about the cash rate?
We don't have a specific kind of rule or benchmark here, but let me just take a step back and explain thinking. If we're going to deliver an average rate of inflation of 2.5%, which I certainly hope we can, and the country gets a labour productivity growth of 1%, certainly hope we can do that, well, let's hope we can do better, and the labour share of national income wants to remain steady, that means that labour costs should grow on average at 3.5%. If they're growing at 2 point something and the country's generating 1% productivity growth, then inflation, I think, is going to be below the midpoint of the target band. So this is where the focus on wages comes from. It's kind of this medium-term relationship between prices, wages and productivity. That's the analytical basis on which we're focusing on wages. The relevant concept isn't really the wage price index. And that gives us a measure of how fast base wages are rising. But I think we all know in a tight labour market, wage increases come through other ways. People getting promotions, but they're really doing the same work and they get paid more. And we know when people switch jobs, even if they're doing pretty much the same job, they get a higher rate of pay. And there's also a greater evidence of bonuses. So we're going to be paying close attention to the broader measures of labour costs. It's been difficult in the past couple of years to look at the measures in the national accounts because they're affected by too many compositional things, but going forward we're paying close attention to those. And we don't have, to answer your question directly, we don't have a specific benchmark, but what we want to see in the wage price index, these broader measures of labour costs and our liaison with business, which is very important, evidence that wages are trending higher. So, well, I think kind of, you know, it's possible we can have, you know, I think this is the other point we're conscious of, it's possible that we could have sustainably high inflation with low wages growth. That means declining real wages. We've seen that in the United Kingdom a number of years ago. So I don't want to kind of give you the impression that we're kind of hanging on every single wage number and got a specific benchmark there, because that's not how we're thinking about it. There's this medium-term relationship. And we're also conscious of the fact that prices can move around for other reasons other than labour costs.
Ron Meisen.
G'day, Governor. Ron Meisen from the Australian Financial Review. Thank you very much for your speech. In the speech that you gave to the National Press Club last year of the same title, you very specifically said that you did not expect the interest rate to be creeping up until 2024 and even potentially beyond that. Absent from this year's speech is any reference to specifically when you think that will happen. But I'm wondering if you could share with us what you, what the bank's central case scenario is for when you believe interest rates will now begin to lift, and what your best case scenario is. And when we last spoke, when I asked you a question, you said that market expectations of multiple rate hikes in 2022 was a complete overreaction to inflation data. Do you still hold that view, or is it looking more rational?
I think what I can say is that the faster progress towards full employment and inflation consistent with the target does bring forward the timing of a likely increase in interest rates. I think we should welcome that. Whether it happens this year or not remains to be determined. It will depend upon how these supply issues are resolved and the strength of the pickup in labour costs. If things go well and the economy performs strongly, then there are clearly scenarios where we'd be increasing rates later this year if some of these uncertainties get resolved in the way that I hope they would. But time will tell. It's certainly a plausible scenario that rates go up later this year, but it's there are a lot of other scenarios as well. So the point I was trying to emphasise in my prepared remarks is that there are a lot of uncertainties, both on the supply side and the labour market dynamics. And because inflation is not that high at the moment, we can wait to see how those uncertainties resolve. If they resolve in one way, then we'll be raising rates. If they resolve in another way, then it's still quite plausible that the first increase in interest rates is a year or longer away. So there's a second part of the question.
Is the market pricing now looking a little more rational?
The thing that I find most surprising at the market pricing at the moment is that in the United States, 4 increase in interest rates roughly are predicted this year. In Australia, the market pricing is for 4 as well. So the market is pricing in the same increase in interest rates in the Australia and the United States by the end of this calendar year. Yet our inflation rate is half what that in the US, and labour cost growth is half that in the US. So that's the thing that I'm kind of still surprised about. We keep looking at the markets and trying to understand what they're telling us, but I still struggle with how the same interest rate reaction is priced in for Australia and the US.
Tiki Fullerton.
Thank you, Governor. Tiki Fullerton from The Australian. You remain very focused on wages growth when it comes to any decision making. You've also just admitted that the bank's economists have vastly underestimated growth in inflation and employment, and 2022 may not be any different. How do you and the board see the risk of inflation getting out of hand and damaging the economy?
I see the risk of that to be very low. because partly the increase in inflation is driven by these supply side problems. I think they will be resolved. One category of the CPI that I've been looking at is the price of electronic goods. Most years they fall, the price of electronic goods fall, the computers and the stuff we buy. In the past year, that component of the CPI has risen. It's risen because we've all sat at home and done shopping and wanted to get our stuff, and then there's been an interruption to the global supply of chips. So the price of chips went right through the roof. So what's, you know, cast forward 6 months, what's likely to happen? I suspect we won't be buying as many electronics, we'll be going to cafes and travelling. And the supply side problems in the chip market are now being resolved and the price of chips are coming down. So I suspect, you know, on that category, we'll go back to more normal rates of increase. The same with cars. There's been problems in producing cars because of chips, and the prices, I think, have gone up 7 or 8% this year. We don't expect car prices to keep going up like that. So I think there'll be some normalisation of these problems resolved. And in the labour market, there's a lot of inertia in the system because of our institutional arrangements. And that inertia is means that I think it's quite unlikely that wage growth picks up to probably problematic rates. So we can't discount stuff happening that we don't expect. It's obvious. But the focus on the ability of the market to solve supply problems and the inertia in Australia's wage system means that the pickup in inflation here is still going to be, in broad terms, fairly modest. And if it's faster than that, we can respond. And the household sector has a lot of debt, so I think they'll be quite responsive to an increase in interest rates. So I'm not worried about inflation getting out of control. And this is one reason why the board is prepared to be patient here. We want to get the unemployment rate down, first time in 50 years, below 4%, fantastic. Let's hope we can do that. And because we're not too worried about a massive inflation outbreak, we're prepared to sit for a while.
Sarah Conti.
Hello, Governor. Sarah Conti, SBS World News. The RBA has several duties, but one is fundamentally to contribute to the welfare of the Australian people. Given property has become so unaffordable, especially to people without access to intergenerational wealth, should the RBA be required to consider the impact of its decisions on house prices and be at least partially responsible for helping make them affordable?
I don't think giving the Reserve Bank responsibility for the kind of controlling the overall level of housing prices in the country makes sense. There are just too many other things that are driving housing prices other than interest rates, aren't there? At the moment, in the past couple of years, people have wanted more space in the house. They've wanted to work from home, and they've wanted kind of, you know, people haven't wanted flatmates or whatever. And so we've wanted more space. The supply of housing is fixed. Demand goes up. What happens to the price? It goes up. And there's nothing we can do with monetary policy to offset that. And probably maybe last year or the year before, I was asked a similar question. I think we have high housing prices in this country because of structural factors. The choices that we make as a society give us high housing prices. We all choose to live in, most of us, in kind of these fabulous cities on the coast. We want large blocks of land. We have restrictive zoning. We've underinvested in transport over the years. And we've got a tax system that's conducive to investment in property. That's why we have structurally high housing prices in the country. They've risen the past year because of lower interest rates and this increased demand for space. But monetary policy can only do so much. And we can't counteract all those other things. If the society doesn't like the current level of housing costs, I think there are structural solutions. The solution isn't to put up interest rates.
Governor, Peter Ryan from the ABC. Thanks for the speech today. Look, I know we've had a lot of fun talking about timelines and dates, 2024, 2023. You've said that 2022 is plausible, but what sort of consideration do you have to make about possibly running too late with pushing rates higher and then being forced into doing aggressive rate hikes when things get out of control and you're having to play catch up?
I mean, that again, that's a possibility, but I think it's unlikely for the two reasons I mentioned before. I think the supply side problems were resolved in a way that takes the pressure out of goods prices, and there's quite a lot of inertia in aggregate wages. If we're wrong there and inflation does pick up and doesn't come down, then we will have to increase interest rates more quickly than I currently think is possible. And I think this remains to be tested, that when interest rates go up this time, the household sector will be quite responsive to it. So it's the same, I think, you kind of answer really in response to Tiki's question. There's sufficient inertia in the system, and if we're wrong about that, then interest rates will have to go up more quickly. But at the moment, it doesn't seem a particularly high probability event.
Edward Boyd, Sky News. Governor, do you believe the RBA being so descriptive about no rate changes until 2024 has seduced a lot of Aussie homeowners and businesses into borrowing money with these record low interest rates? And if rates now do rise earlier, do you bear any responsibility? Was this the right guidance to have given families and businesses over the last 2 years?
Well, at no point have we said rates will not go up till 2024. I know that's how often it gets characterised, but what I've always tried to do is to set out our forecasts, our reaction function, and then over the past couple of years drew an inference about if those forecasts come to pass, what that meant for interest rates. That has not constituted a promise, it's a probabilistic statement. Sometimes that subtlety doesn't come across as well as I would like it to, but we have not made a promise that interest rates wouldn't go up. We said based on these forecasts, we don't think they will, but the forecasts change and then the outlook for interest rates changes. The fact that people expect interest rates to stay low for a few years has been important in helping the economic recovery. The fact that people have been prepared to invest in housing, that spending is helping. We've got extremely strong residential construction at the moment, and that's helping. And the end result of that, we shouldn't forget this, is more people have jobs in Australia than ever before. As I said in my prepared remarks, the share of the working age population with a job has never been higher than it is today, and it's going to go higher. And that's a real benefit to people and to communities. The housing price issues can be solved through other ways, but this reduction, sustained reduction in unemployment, is of great benefit to the country, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Daniel Sutton.
G'day, Governor. Daniel Sutton from the 10 Network. Over a million Australian mortgage holders have never experienced a hike in the cash rate now, and so obviously those people are now looking very carefully at your words, trying to read the tea leaves and work out what they do with their mortgages. You can't obviously go to the RBA governor looking for individual financial advice, but if it was your mortgage, would you be scrambling for a fixed rate or would you be sticking with variable?
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't thought about it, but the advice that I would be... I've lived in my house for more than 25 years, and over those 25 years I've been able to... I'm in the fortunate position of having paid it off. But the advice that I would give to people is make sure you have buffers. You know, interest rates will go up, and the stronger is the economy, the better progress we make on unemployment, the faster and the sooner the increase in interest rates will be. So interest rates will go up, we need to be prepared for that, and people need to have buffers. And the positive news is that when we look at the data, most households are paying off more than is required by the current level of interest rates. They're keeping money in their offset accounts and their redraw facilities, so there's a lot of capacity for many borrowers to keep their current level of spending even with higher interest rates because they've built up these buffers. So make sure you have your buffer, because as I've talked about multiple times, unexpected things can happen. But one of the things that I think will happen is interest rates will go up. I can't tell you when, but they will go up.
Swati Pandey.
Hello, Governor. Swati Pandey from Bloomberg News. My question is on interest rates again. We have your forecasts are projecting the economy, inflation, unemployment, all moving in the right direction. And already we have seen that happening. So why not start raising rates like from what we have right now? It's pandemic era setting, 0.1%. Why not start with 15 basis points already, given that inflation is within the band and unemployment is at a 13-year low? Why wait?
Why wait? I think the answer, the main part of the answer there is there are uncertainties. Remember, I think I've said this three or four times already, we've just got to the midpoint of the target band for underlying inflation for the first time in 7 years. That in and of itself isn't a need to raise interest rates, and we've got to that point because of these unprecedented problems in global supply chains. And wages growth is still at a rate we know from before the pandemic wasn't consistent with achieving the target. So given those preconditions and the uncertainties that exist, I think it's the appropriate thing to do to wait and to try and do what we can to get the unemployment rate down and then move later once those uncertainties are resolved and we do have that success in getting unemployment down. And this, I think it was Tiki's question about the likelihood of a severe pickup in inflation. I think that's quite unlikely. So we have time to wait.
Sorry, and, what I'm actually trying to understand is, do we really need the pandemic era monetary policy setting right now?
Sorry, I missed the...
Do we really need the pandemic era monetary policy setting right now?
Do we need them? They're helpful in getting the unemployment rate down and getting the nominal part of the economy growing at the same rate. I mean, I think we have a unique opportunity here to get people into jobs and get their incomes growing more quickly. And we can do that without running an unacceptable risk on inflation. The board has made the judgment that's an appropriate trade-off. You know, managing the risk of inflation being too high, we've got to be conscious of that, but you know, there's great benefit in getting unemployment down. And we can do that, I think, safely. If it turns out to be wrong, then we'll have to raise rates more quickly, and this is why the buffers will be so important.
Peter Harcher.
Governor, thanks for your speech today. Peter Harcher, Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. With the enormous expansion of government fiscal policy in recent years, plus the strength of the bounce back that you've described today, is this the time that governments, federal and state, should be starting to retrench fiscal policy and tighten spending?
Should be starting to entrench?
Retrench fiscal policy and tighten
spending. Well, I'm not going to give governments advice on fiscal policy. I think the general point I make here is that over the past couple of years, governments have borrowed a huge amount of money, and they borrowed that against the country's future income. It was exactly the right thing to do. Private incomes were weak because we couldn't work in the pandemic. The governments borrowed and supplemented private sector incomes with money they borrowed from the future. Perfectly sensible, and I've been strongly supportive of that. The result of that is that there's a higher level of public debt than we've been used to. So at a very high level, there are two ways you can respond to that. The first is to run tighter fiscal policy than you otherwise would have. That means less government spending or higher taxes. The second way of responding to this is making sure our future income grows very, very quickly. So I think the best way to deal with the debt problems isn't to run really restrictive fiscal policy. It's to do whatever we can to make sure that future income is strong. We borrowed against it, let's make it strong. And this is why the productivity agenda of the government is so important. Because the best way to deal with the fiscal problems is make sure future income growth is strong, and then the debt to income ratio will take care of itself. So I'm not going to provide advice on whether the government should have a tighter or looser fiscal policy, but I do think it's important that both governments and business really focus on lifting national productivity so our future income is strong and we can pay down those debts.
I'll pick you up on the productivity point then, if Laura will indulge me just for a second. You've emphasised the centrality of productivity growth. You've said in years past that governments recognised intellectually the need for productivity reform, which obviously in Australia in recent years has been a failure with the dwindling and then stagnation of productivity growth. Do you think governments in Australia have yet constructed the agenda for productivity growth that you've long called for?
I'm not going to pass judgment on that, but I know they are. The current government is focused on infrastructure, on skills, on research and development. So lowering taxes and kind of tax reform. So they've got initiatives in each of these key areas, and I'll leave it to you and others to judge whether that's going to be enough to make sure that future income is what we need, and that we can generate the big increases in real wages. I think that in previous years I'd spoken a lot about infrastructure, and I think we've made progress there. The emphasis in the next period, I think, really has to be on human capital accumulation. It's skills and technology. I understand governments are working on that and trying to improve the delivery of public services, but you know, we've got to do more there. But I'll let you be the judge rather than me sitting in judgment.
Thanks for your address, Governor. Quentin Dempster from the New Daily. We heard the Prime Minister say at the press club yesterday, and you've given us the substantiation of that in your wonderful graphs today, that there's every prospect unemployment in Australia could drop to an historic low of 3%, or at least in the threes. You've indicated the conditions in the job market currently should result in systemic wages growth. Do you accept that these conditions are partly the result of the suspension of Australia's usually high migration rate because of COVID border closures 2 years ago? And rather than get Australia back to immigration to resume the trend to a total population of 40 million by 2055, shouldn't we be seriously thinking about further curtailing migration, at least for a time, while we enjoy fuller employment, higher wages, and catch up with this country's infrastructure backlog, particularly housing?
I don't think the main thing going on here is the cut in immigration. That's not the main. The main thing going on is the large fiscal stimulus and the monetary policy support. That's a very powerful combination, one that we haven't seen for a long time. Very large fiscal stimulus, unprecedented monetary policy measures, and they've worked. That's what's driven the unemployment rate down and, in time, wages up. I say that partly because I'm looking at the evidence overseas as well. Like in Europe, the unemployment rate came out last night, it's kind of multi-decade lows. That's not because they closed the borders. They're just kind of, there's been a lot of fiscal stimulus and monetary easing. And the US, the unemployment rate's come down as well. Most countries in the world, the unemployment rate has come down because we've had this macroeconomic experiment in a way where we've had very large fiscal stimulus around the world and very large monetary stimulus. And surprise, surprise, you put those two things together, it works. That's the lesson I draw from it. The closure of the borders has affected some segments of the labour market. We all know kind of the problems in hospitality and agriculture and some professional services. But that's, the closure of the borders isn't what driven the unemployment rate down and wages up. It's the combined monetary and fiscal stimulus and actually the resilience of Australians and their preparedness to kind of get out and adjust and do things.
I know it's not a remit, yeah, but do you want to see the migration rate resume back to trend?
I'm not going to offer kind of commentary on that, but I think allowing people to come into the country and make it easy for people to come into the country with skills is incredibly important. Many businesses tell us through our liaison that they're either delaying investment or not expanding because they can't get the skills at the moment, and opening up the borders and having those people come in will allow businesses to expand, invest, increase the country's capital stock and add to our collective human capital. So having people come in with skills is incredibly important, and I'll leave it to others to judge how fast that should be.
Governor, we're just on time, but are you happy to keep taking some questions?
I'm in your hands, yes.
Oh, okay, well, in that case. Peter Hannum.
Yeah, Peter Hannum from The Guardian. Look, you mentioned a list of challenges. I note there was no mention of climate change, and you talk about supply disruptions and so on. We only have to look at the Nullarbor Plain at the moment to see what extreme weather can do to Australia's supplies, supply lines. So I'm just wondering whether we should take a view that maybe climate change is not a serious priority from the admission in your speech today. Also, I think the Guardian readers, some of them being market fundamentalists that they are, want to know that after you've unwound or started to unwind that massive bond buying, 42% of government debt, for example, which has obviously distorted some elements of the market, is it not inevitable that there'll be some sizable losses that'll have to be covered from the budget and perhaps in the billions of dollars?
Laura, I don't know how, whether you want, they're about two big questions. I could talk on each of those for a long time, so I'm not quite sure how much. On the fact that I didn't talk about climate change today, is it's certainly not a reflection of the priority we put on it. I wanted to do my best to keep to the time limit I was given. There are important issues to address, and I chose to address those rather than climate change. Our institution is spending a huge amount of time on climate change from various perspectives, both kind of the effects of on investment, particularly in the energy sector, the implications of that. It has effect on pricing through the Council of Financial Regulators, looking at insurance and the risk profile of the banking system, and I would say the desirability of Australia as an investment destination. So I could give you a 50-minute talk on that, but I'll choose not to, but the fact that I didn't talk about it today isn't a reflection of the weight we're giving to that issue. On the issue of the bank's profits, there are, central bank accounting is kind of complicated, but the way I think about it is that we have bought all these bonds at yields between 10 basis points, which is the lowest we bought at, and 2%. So we've got these assets that we expect to hold to maturity, and we'll earn somewhere between 10 basis points and 2% on each of those assets until they mature. The offsetting liability we have is the exchange settlement balances. At the moment, we're paying zero on exchange settlement balances. So we're earning a positive running yield, which is accumulating on the bond that we earned 2% running, 2% running, net running yield on that. Over time, as the rate on exchange settlement balances increases, the running yield will decline, and for some bonds it will go negative. So the rate at which interest rates go up will determine the profile of our profits. So we've done a lot of simulation work to look at how the profits would evolve under various runoff profiles for our balance sheet and profiles for interest rates. So that's how I'm thinking about it. The other way of looking at it, which is the way the financial accounts deal with it, is use market value accounting. And when you use market values, it telescopes all the future gains or losses into today. So you're going to see quite large swings, possibly some large losses in capital losses on the Reserve Bank balance sheet, because the market pricing telescopes all the future things into today. The Reserve Bank is a very well capitalized institution. We retain some additional capital this year to deal with the potential losses. As those losses come through, I expect there'll be smaller dividends to the government for a number of years, but we're a well capitalized institution. It's not a concern I have.
Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel. While drawing your forecast, you're assuming market pricing for cash rate hikes. Now, this time, market is pricing nearly 200 basis points of rate hikes over your forecast period. Could you explain how this has affected your forecast? And if you're still forecasting 2.5% underlying inflation at the end of the forecast period, does it mean you're sort of endorsing market pricing?
If I understand the question, is kind of what are we assuming about the path of interest rates in preparing our forecasts? And we're using the market path, which has, as I said before, three or four interest rate increases in it this year. So we're using something broadly similar to that in the preparation of our forecasts. The main impact that has in what happens in late 23 and 24, because there's a lag, as you know, between interest rate changes and the effect on activity and unemployment and inflation. So we are assuming the market path, and that is one of the factors that will bring inflation down.
So that means you will need that kind of rate hikes to still have inflation at 2.5 at the end of your forecast period. So when you're assuming that and you're still arriving at that forecast, does it mean you need those number of rate hikes?
So the alternative assumption to use that we kind of do occasionally is just keep interest rates unchanged through the forecast horizon. And if we'd done that, then inflation would be higher at the end of the forecast period than we've got. So I don't know, is that the...
Yep. Jonathan Shapiro.
Governor Lowe, Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. Thanks for extending the time to take my question. Noting your scepticism or cynicism of market pricing, I wanted to get your view on the Australian 10-year bond rate, which the RBA would own a lot of those securities. The rate is around just under 2%, which is below the Reserve Bank's lower band of its inflation target. What do you make of that seeming disconnect between a short end, which is pricing in a 1% cash rate before the end of the year, and looking out to 10 years, a market that either sees slower growth or no threat of inflation? Just interested in yours and the bank's perspective on the message being sent by the longer end of the bond market.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's something we discuss not just in Australia but internationally, because the US 10-year bond yield is pretty much the same as ours. In a way, I find it kind of remarkable that the markets expect the US to go from 7% inflation to 2 or 2.5% without real interest rates at longer ends becoming positive. So maybe that's going to happen. It's going to be remarkable, isn't it, that we go from 7% to 2% inflation without positive real interest rates. So I still am struggling to understand that. And we're looking at the market pricing and talking to market people about why that is the case. But it's a kind of open question. Can other countries get their inflation rates down without having real interest rates turn positive? I'm very hopeful that over time these real interest rates will turn positive, and they'll do that if we can generate the productivity growth, because there's a link between long-term real interest rates and the underlying rate of productivity growth the country can generate. So let's hope that we get to positive long-term real interest rates, because that will mean stronger growth and stronger productivity. But it's a good question and something that we puzzle over a lot.
Anna Henderson.
Thank you, Governor. Anna Henderson from SBS World News and NITV. Look, you have touched on this a little bit already, but as people do fill up their petrol tanks, buy a loaf of bread or buy a RAT test potentially, what's wrong with our system that unemployment can be tracking so low and at the same time we're not seeing significant wages growth, and what needs to be done to fix it?
I mean, wage growth is picking up. This is the kind of the Reserve Bank really for a long time has been, its strategy has been to get the unemployment rate down, put pressure on the labour market, wages growth to pick up, inflation to rise to target, and normalisation of interest rates. So that's been kind of our underlying strategy, and I see that actually working now. Inflation is eating into some people's wages, and you know it's very difficult when you're filling your car up at $2 a litre. It really eats into households' budgets. So I know that's very difficult at the moment for many people. The counterbalance to that is people have jobs, and they're going to get bigger pay rises over the next couple of years because of the macroeconomic strategies that have followed. So it swings and roundabouts, isn't it? You're paying more for some of the things you buy, but you've got a job, and hopefully, if the unemployment rate's low and the labour market's tight, you'll get a bigger pay rise and you'll be better off. That's the strategy.
Will you be spending that on your mortgage?
Sorry?
Will you just be spending it on your mortgage?
Well, some people will and some people won't. And hopefully some people can draw on the buffers they've built up. Because interest rates can go up a bit and people don't need to change their repayments if they've got a big buffer that's built up or they're paying more than the regular amount. And many people, not everyone can do that, not everyone's in the position to do that, but some people can. So I think we've got to keep in mind that getting people into jobs and giving bigger pay rises has huge benefits, both for the budget and for the people's budgets and for the society. And you know, really, that's what we're trying to do.
Just while Julie comes to the microphone, just on that point though, you talked in your earlier remarks about inertia and about supply and demand problems. I mean, isn't it the case that the fact that wages aren't going up high does suggest there are structural problems in the wages market and you know in institutional settings? And isn't that something that we've got to address, with a classic case in point being at the moment the aged care workforce?
There's inertia in the system. Is that a problem or is it a positive? There are kind of wage relativity issues in our labour market that are significant and they're worth looking at. I agree 100% with that, but the Reserve Bank can't do anything about wage relativities. What we can do is get the unemployment rate down so everyone gets bigger pay rises. So we only have so many instruments, and I think if we can get unemployment down, people get bigger wage rises. They'll have to get them right across the board. And in a way, inertia in the system's positive because it allows us to take more time on monetary policy, doesn't it? If, you know, in the US, wage growth has spiked very quickly, and probably they'll have to respond to that. But we have time. So.
Thank you, Governor. Julie Hare from the Australian Financial Review, and I'm also on the board of the National Press Club. The jury is out in Australia as to whether we are undergoing the Great Resignation, as in the United States. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts or insights in whether it's happening here or whether it's going to happen and what that means for wages growth. Thank you.
Well, we're looking at the data on this. In the US, a lot of older people have left the labour force. So that's a lot of the resignation is older people that they may not want to deal with the health situation or the kind of the caring, they might have had caring responsibilities or whatever, but older people in the US have left the labour force in droves. That's not the case in Australia. Some younger people in the US have left, but that's not the main story. In Australia, what we're seeing now, for the first time in many years, is quite a rate of job hopping and job switching. In previous talks, I've talked about the low rate of job switching in Australia, and that was one of the things that was depressing aggregate wage outcomes. Unemployment comes down, plenty of opportunities, people switch jobs and they get bigger pay rises. And labour force participation is at a record high here. And I think it's going to go higher. So, you know, if the Australians want to work, there are opportunities there and they're going to get rewarded for it. So I'm not worried about people leaving the labour force here in large numbers. But it's something we're watching.
Final question is from Andrew Tillett.
Andrew Tillett from the Financial Review and also our Vice President of the Press Club here. I'd like to ask about the C word, China, and what the impact, you know, China might have on your forecast for the year ahead. We're obviously seeing stagnant sort of economic growth figures in the back half of the year. They've done a bit of monetary stimulus recently. Obviously, the questions over the Chinese property sector and the obsession with COVID zero over there too. What's your assessment of the risks that they might pose to the global economy?
I think the first point to make here is growth in China is trending lower. I mean, we've been through a truly extraordinary period where they had very high rates of growth. That's trending lower. So we have to get used to a world in which growth in China is lower. It's still strong, but it's lower. Right at the moment, as you were alluding to, they're dealing with two really difficult issues. The first is the deleveraging of their property sector. We know property has been incredibly important to China's progress. And leverage was built up a lot, and the authorities now want to unwind that leverage. And we know in any financial system, unwinding leverage is difficult. And the Chinese are dealing with that at the moment. I think it's having having a big effect on their property market, and that has ripple effects through the rest of the economy. The authorities have responded to that a bit, but not particularly strongly. So that's one challenge, and how you balance off the need to deleverage but keep the property sector going. It's hard to get that right. And the other big issue they're trying to balance, as you know, and is COVID. They've still got very low numbers of COVID and they're trying to make sure that remains the case. We know from our own experience here, it's very hard to do that with Omicron and whatever comes next. So how do they balance the need to keep COVID low, and they're having restrictions in some parts of the country at the moment that's affecting the supply chain again. So they're two real, put those two things together, big challenges. They've got things to balance and we're watching it carefully.
Yes, I made a wrong forecast because we do have one more question from Tim Shaw.
We'll do that, so don't worry.
Tim Shaw, Director of the National Press Club. Governor, are we seeing the greatest intergenerational exchange of wealth between the Bank of Mum and Dad and younger Australians, because those self-funded retirees are not getting any return from their cash deposits and are not sophisticated share traders? Do you see an increase in that intergenerational wealth transfer over the next couple of years, whomever is in government in Canberra?
Well, it's possible, but we've got to remember the self-funded retirees, that many of them have benefited from decades of house price appreciation, from rise in the equity prices and stronger wages growth over much of their working life. So there are swings and roundabouts here, and it really depends upon your perspective, but there is a growing trend, as you were alluding to, of parents and grandparents helping their children into the property market. And the high level of housing prices means that that's going to be an ongoing feature of our economy, I think. You can look at that in a couple of ways. One, say that's good because it's helping children. Another perspective is it just reinforces the existing distribution of wealth within society. It's fine if your parents can help you or your grandparents can help you, but if your parents aren't in that situation, then you're going to find it harder to get into the property market. And my own perspective is that that has negative repercussions over time. So, you know, it's a complicated issue. It's not one the Reserve Bank can do anything about, but it's the world we're in.